So I'm really fascinated by the power of one or the power of two, three individuals that often set the spark and that can induce nonviolent macro changes. Because wherever you go, you find people move their village or their youth forward in some way or the other. And these were really profound experiences. I was a magazine journalist in my early 20s, and that job took me often self-organized to Bosnia, all the way to Lake Baikal. And I was in Washington, D.C. on 9/11. I was in Hungary to cover a cyanide spill in a river in February 2000, traveling in minibuses across to Romania. And everywhere I found myself with people, with societies whose life had been turned upside down.
Hope Punk is a podcast about choosing hope in the face of adversity. Hope, meant as an activating force, not wishful thinking. The term was originally coined by fantasy author Alexandra Rowland, who in 2017 wrote a Tumblr post simply stating, "The opposite of grimdark is hope punk. Pass it on." Now, grimdark is a particularly dystopian subgenre of science fiction. And hope punk doesn't negate that dystopia exists, but it says, in the face of it, choose hope anyway. In a world that is unkind, just being kind is in itself a radical act. And while some would want to make us believe otherwise, hope punk is everywhere. That's why it is my intention with this podcast to shine a light on the people, projects, and spaces that embody hope-inspired action every day. My guest today is Verena Ringler, founder and head of European Commons and Agora, a boutique think and do tank based in Innsbruck, Austria. I met her around 15 years ago in a remote Austrian monastery where a group of us was convened on the invitation of a few European foundations. If I remember correctly, Verena was the mastermind behind the format, which lured a select group of so-called EU insiders, meaning people who worked in or closely with European institutions or politicians, to join a group of largely unknown EU outsiders, of which I was one, to think about the future of Europe. I invited Verena to be in this podcast because she is an innovator at the intersection between political institutions on the one hand and players outside of politics in science, business, and civil society on the other hand. She's also just a very close observer of the European Union. Time and again, Verena seeks to strengthen voices that often get overlooked because they are seemingly too irrelevant or too small or too far away from the centers of power in the capitals or in Brussels. But instead of buying into that narrative, Verena takes these voices seriously and seeks to empower them. Being effective in that field is no easy feat, but Verena has been consistently building her track record for more than 25 years. She started her career as a journalist and spent several years working, for instance, for the U.S. magazine Foreign Policy, living in Washington, D.C. Later, she returned to Europe and joined a team around the special representative of the Council of the European Union in Kosovo as deputy head of press and public affairs. Since then, she has worked independently but also within institutions, for instance, as head of international affairs and Europe projects at Stiftung Mercator. She is also a former visiting fellow at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Verena, thank you so much for joining me. What's your take on hope?
Well, thank you for inviting me, Maite. And to me, hope is three things at once. It's a competence, it's a compass, but it's also a condition of resistance. Why a competence? I realized some years ago that hope is something we need to practice and train like a really difficult board or craft. Hope is not something that comes to us, you know, like from the blue sky, but we have to train it so hard that we become masters in it and that it's more than a skill and really turns into a competence. And why is it a compass? Hope to me is also a moral compass because hope, wherever I encounter it, gives us, on the one hand, the security of the direction, but also the consolation that it's of a non-violent quality. Wherever I meet people who exhibit an attitude and a sense of hope, I realize that this is an infinite source. And the people who exhibit hope mirror a deeply empathic relationship with all living things and with the planet as such. And in that sense, hope is a compass because it's not extractionary. It's not finite. It's an infinite source and an infinite sort of compass of a direction. And the third aspect that I find particularly important in this very time is that hope is resistance. Hope, to me, is a very powerful tool to focus the energy and attention on solutions, on the people and the initiatives that work on solutions for the many and not just a few. And in that vein, every glimpse of hope that we sense, that we cultivate consciously, is an act of resistance. Hope is not some naivete, but it's a very strong and hard foundation. And therefore, it's also in itself an act of resistance. Resistance against extraction, short-termism, oligarchy, autocracy, colonialism. So hope to me is a competence, but also a condition of resistance.
Thank you so much. I love that. You are someone who is very well-versed in the situation in Eastern Europe as well, in post-communist Europe. You have traveled almost all countries of the former Soviet bloc. And right now, we see in Albania the so-called Flamingo Revolution, which has been going on at this point for about 9 consecutive days in resistance to plans by Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump to turn a protected island into a luxury resort. In how far are your three elements of hope that you outlined so eloquently, competency, compass, and resistance, in how far can you apply those to the situation in Albania?
Well, Albania is actually a great example. I have been visiting Albania several times since the year 2000. I was there last year in 2025 as an election observer for the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. And I have long followed the years and years and years of very professional and patent civil society players to make the Vjosa River Valley a protected area. And it was a huge victory by players like Patagonia, the firm, but also a range and a huge number of European and Balkan civil society organizations when finally in the year 2021 or 2022, they all managed to declare the Vjosa River as the last wild river in Europe, a fully protected zone. And I have seen for years the creativity, the fearlessness, the freedom of action in cultural and civil society players in the Balkans and especially in Albania. And it's not that all these organizations and demonstrators pop up out of the blue now. They have been working on this consistently. They have developed the competence of hope. They know that Albania has had a reputational uphill battle in the EU. And they know that you have to have your data, your facts together. You have to have your legal knowledge. You have to have good funders and so on in order to be able to create change and have an impact in a country like Albania. And why is hope a compass? In the case of the Flamingo Revolution, what we see now is the top of an iceberg. The preparatory work, the energy, the social, the professional work to actually come to such a civic, nonviolent people movement from one day to the other requires years and usually decades of background preparations. We see in Albania today something that we have seen in 1989 in many European countries, where we have to also go back many years before 89 in order to understand why in this very minute that history breaks, then a lot of key multipliers in a society are ready, they are professional, they have been following their own compass in order to stand for their own values and convictions. And the third aspect, the hope as resistance, I think we don't have to go much deeper in this moment, because the Flamingo Revolution in itself is so joyful. It's so beautiful. It's nonviolent. There are a lot of women, a lot of children who play a role, who discover their voice and who make their voice heard, often for the first time. To me, actually, the Flamingo Revolution is not just a beautiful case study in hope in its three dimensions as a competence, a compass, and a condition of resistance, but it also is a belated 1989 moment of Albanian society.
It sounds almost like a roadmap, what you describe. It almost sounds like cultivating soil of different institutions, different initiatives of civic life and civil society organizations, outside actors who set the scene. And then, you know, when the moment comes, these actors are willing and able to jump on the same train because they share a moral compass and then, you know, join forces in resistance. Is that a fair summary of what you just said?
They first managed to make the Vjosa River Valley a naturally protected zone. And this was a really big victory of a very diverse civic coalition of businesses, of celebrities, and of civil society organizations.
What you describe around Albania really sounds like resilience. Resilience of a country, of a people. How does that connect to your work? Because you have focused your entire career on strengthening Europe.
Well, I think the question of hope in its three dimensions that we see now coming out of Albania very well mirrors the larger questions that we are dealing with in many variations in Europe every day. And this has always been about the change of the boundaries between common or public interests on the one hand and particular private interests on the other hand. And I have been very interested in the last decades to understand the civic abilities and civic power that is necessary and that includes businesses and science organizations in order to protect and claim and reclaim the spaces and the goods that are common and public goods. So the topics that I work on often and always have as a deep undercurrent the deep conflicts between public and common interests on the one hand and particular or private interests on the other hand. And so resilience is always not just the ability of a system, let's say Albanian society in this case, to absorb a crisis or deal with a shock, but that either a system manages to prevent that crisis in the first place or is able to bounce forward with increased strength.
Is that the same as pushing back, in your view?
No. Basically, what I want to say is what we see in the abilities of people now and what we see when we talk about resilience is the ability to transform. It's the ability to modernize and to sometimes push through a birth channel, so to say, of a topic, of a country, of a situation. And that transformation is sometimes quite intense. It's messy. And this is when a system can be called resilience. That society or that country or that topic emerges in a stronger, in a transformed, and in a modernized afterwards.
It's basically like a pressure pot. And then it's about consolidation.
Yeah, but consolidation can never be to go back to a state of reality that was, but resilience describes the successful shift of a system from one reality to a next improved or better one.
Yes, going from past through a present shock into a future, into a more desirable future. Yes or no?
Absolutely. You know, I think we often overlook that. And this is what my whole focus lies on, is that I talk to policymakers, and in my perception, I see the current threats, the current challenges and crises that we face in Europe as invitations for transformation. And I argue that we do have the ingredients and we do have the maturity of Civic Europe to actually use these threats and challenges in order to transform our overall system with increased intensity and speed.
In order to face the many geopolitical challenges that Europe is facing and also the challenges that Europe is facing from within?
Yes, because I treat the European system as a constant interplay of the institutions with societies, including the organizations in science and in businesses. So if we treat Europe as a system, then we know and understand that one single acupuncture point at some spot in that system can unblock a whole circuit of progress or life or energy in that system. And I very much believe in that systemic approach to our European future rather than the still dominant linear and siloed approach.
How did you become someone who works or who believes in the power of these systems? What shaped you?
Well, I think there are two main phases in my childhood and youth. On the one hand, as a child, I was exposed to the creativity and the impact of nonviolent resistance movements like the one against apartheid in South Africa in the 1980s, where in our supermarkets in Innsbruck, Austria, we saw signs at the pineapple box that said, "Don't buy fruit from South Africa." And I also got to know the free trade coffee concept in the 1980s. And unconsciously, I was empowered, but also fascinated by the idea that we as one family, you know, as an individual who pays something at the supermarket cashier, can really be in a direct connection to somebody on the other side of the planet and help to create a necessary change for people over there. And then 1989 happened. And this was the fall of the Berlin Wall and the Iron Curtain. It was macro change that was more or less peaceful and nonviolent. And I was really fascinated how these Monday prayer meetings in Leipzig had been going on for years until the moment came and 1989 arrived. And then people had the necessary energy, the necessary mass of hope to push through with the movement of opening Europe. So I'm really fascinated by the power of one or the power of two, three individuals that often set the spark and that can induce nonviolent macro changes. And I do think that these changes in comparison to wars are greatly understudied and overlooked in the international relations schools, because wherever you go, you find people move their village or their youth forward in some way or the other. And these were really profound experiences. I was a magazine journalist in my early 20s, and that job took me often self-organized to Bosnia all the way to Lake Baikal. And I was in Washington, D.C. on 9/11. I was in Hungary to cover a cyanide spill in a river in February 2000, traveling in minibuses across to Romania. And everywhere, Maite, everywhere I found myself with people, with societies whose life had been turned upside down, sometimes overnight, sometimes gradually, by disaster or by design. I met this mother in Central Asia who had to bring her daughter home from mathematics studies in Moscow so that the daughter would learn how to preserve and prepare fruit and vegetables in order to live a life without electricity again in the late 1990s or in the years after that. I saw deindustrialization early on, and I saw a lot of despair also in Irkutsk with terrible drugs coming from Afghanistan. There was this very simple school teacher in Irkutsk, Russia, who in his free time tried everything to get the youth away from drugs because parents in the post-communist years were so overwhelmed and so extremely embarrassed and ashamed about their young people falling to drugs, that they had to hide them and sometimes did terrible things in order to not tell the neighbors and not have this issue sort of become the news in the street. And I saw patterns at some point. I saw patterns in these dynamics of societies taking communities forward in terrible and difficult situations. And everywhere, and always, from some really surprising corner, somebody rises to leadership. This is what I discovered in my early journeys as a reporter and journalist to many of the peripheries of our Eurasian continent. And I decided I want to cultivate and to boost that special leadership. So I began to specialize in mega themes of the future and in transition processes. So what I do is I see Europe and its society as a system. I map the players and voices of a certain topic, let's say biodiversity. So the moment I have my map together, I dedicate my energy to see the potential of that topic and in that theme moving forward. I operate, you could say, as an opportunities manager for the common good. So I identify a topic as promising, then I scout cooperation partners who have a mandate or who have the resources and who want to become part of the solution. And these partners always know that early investment in a topic or in a particular group of people will always pay off, because it's about prevention. It's like in health, right? Prevention is usually the most effective, efficient, and joyful way forward. And that is something we could call the theory of change of hope, because it's a specific and very technical idea to boost a topic or a circle of people that I deem are important for our common future.
So this sounds very much like fostering resilience and going into, you know, planning what is a desirable future and working within the existing system, bringing in voices that you think are relevant to then go through that process of transformation you just described. How do you do what you do?
Well, if I run through a typical day in my work, I divide that day in three parts. The one part are events. I initiate and I host regular seminars at masterclasses on a mountain in Innsbruck. And the next one is with the grandson of the EU founder, Jean Monnet. So I do these things to always build that bridge between grand conversations, let's say on European resilience in Brussels, on the one hand, and the daily realities and the questions of people outside these capitals, on the other hand. And the second thing I do is I raise my voice. I do that as much as possible, even though it's often challenging. I do it in the classic media, in social media, in networks, stakeholder circles, because of that ethos of hope. And the third thing I really do are research and practice projects that I initiate or I apply for with my team. These are projects that sometimes, you know, run under the headline of resilience, but more often they are about topics like how can we boost biodiversity care? How can we build so-called living labs in our regions? How can we boost the construction transition towards climate neutrality? And overall, I think I do these events to produce hope. I raise my voice to distribute hope, and I do the research and practice projects to scale hope.
Thank you. Now, Europe as a political project has always been imperfect and unfinished, but I think we both agree that it is worth the effort, you know, with all the flaws that the European Union has and all the flaws that we see in this ecosystem that you work in. And of course, you also describe the peripheries of Europe itself. What is it about the European project that fascinates you so much as to dedicate your working life to it, or to working within it to affect the kind of change that you talk about?
There are three things that really fascinate me about the European project. On the one hand, it's the design. On the other hand, it's the delivery. And as a third point, it's the pole position on resilience that Europe has been building in the last 30 years. So why the design? I have to say, I find the European Union the best, the smartest, the most resilient setup to find common solutions in a democratic manner among not just 27 countries, but also an array of different interests and an array of cultural and administrative differences that we, of course, have between, let's say, Finland and Spain. And to me, the European Union in its design is really the best ever relationship advice body that we have in our midst, because it shows and showcases every day for so many decades that relations and relationship are a decision and not a sheer promise, and that those are full of crises and moments of pain, sometimes exclusion, but at the same time, the relationship competency that we all need as individuals is really beautifully lived in the European Union, in the hallways, in the plenary sessions every day. And I know many of us only see the conflict and the polarization because those are the moments that make it to our national news in the evening. And these are also an important and key part of European Union. There wouldn't be a democratic system without conflict.
I was going to say it's a core element of democracy to have conflict and to be able to deal with conflict.
And overall, if we look at the European Union from the bird's eye view after all these decades, it's an amazing showcase of relationship competence and of resilience. So overall, the theory of change, of supranationality, still holds. And we do see and we do have to respect the daily and democratic cooperation among representatives of 27 different political, administrative, social governance cultures, and what have you. So the design in itself, I think, is for the long term. It's the epitome of sustainability, but also of resilience, because the EU is built like an earthquake-secure high-rise building in Japan, meaning it can gently shift when an earthquake comes, but it doesn't break. And that brings me to the second point. Why do I see the EU as so effective and efficient despite the odds? It's the delivery. Because overall, we have to be honest, the EU has not only survived all the crises and challenges of the past years, but it actually matured as a problem solver. If we think back of the euro and the financial crisis just some years ago, the profound challenge of enlarging to, at that time, 28 countries, if we then look at Brexit, if we look at the pandemic, at climate change, at biodiversity loss, at war, we can say, yes, there are shortcomings and contradictions, but overall, the EU has matured into a world power in itself. And that happened in the last 30 years without a lot of fanfare around it. But I think that's quite remarkable. And the third aspect why I'm fascinated by the European Union, and I believe in the European Union, especially now, is that the EU has invested in resilience. We had the Maastricht Treaty in 1992, and the Maastricht Treaty remains the basis of today's European Union.
Just for those who are not familiar with the Maastricht Treaty.
Well, it was designed and devised mainly by Jacques Delors, a really great French president of the Commission and European policymaker. And by designing the Maastricht Treaty, he built the foundations, the legal and governance foundations of an EU after the fall of the Iron Curtain and the Berlin Wall. So for an enlarged EU, but also for a much more open, democratic and citizen power EU. For instance, the European Parliament got more rights in the Maastricht Treaty, but also in the ensuing treaty changes afterwards. But also things like the immense investment in scientific and research programs like Horizon Europe, in people-to-people and student mobility programs like Erasmus, and also the idea of a European citizenship.
Yes, very important.
Have all been enshrined in the Maastricht Treaty. So we still have to live up to all the possibilities that the Maastricht Treaty holds. What is clear to me is that no US, no China, no Russia have programs like a new European Bauhaus that bring all the players in cities and urban and village contexts around the table on architecture, on building, on construction, on space, biodiversity and people. None of these world powers has an Erasmus program that allows for so many young people, not just students at the university, to discover Europe by living in a different country and studying at a different university for some time. None of these countries has this intense cross-university, cross-regional cooperation like we have it in all these programs and Euregio setups where different regions work together.
May I dive in? Because is that really true? Because in the US, maybe you don't have that mandated by the state, but you have traditionally had a very rich philanthropic landscape that has been investing in this cross-university collaboration, exchange programs. You know, like, and so far you had traditionally, at least in the US, similar structures. For the other ones, I cannot say. But is your argument that in Europe that this is actually part of the institutionalized design?
It's part of an institutionalized decision and an investment into something that isn't yet fully harvested and harnessed. Mm-hmm. But looking at our world powers in the year 2026, the US has been dismantling its whole idea and system and financing of free and open science and universities, and they are struggling to keep that spirit up in certain corners of hope. And you see the EU as the one world player that says, choose Europe for science. And literally the EU right now is the only world power where science is truly free and open. And that is something that has to be seen, but also respected and preserved in the next long-term budget of the EU.
Yes, in the interest of long-term resilience and democracy. Now, the EU is increasingly under threat, and there are very powerful forces who are seeking to dismantle the EU. And I would agree with you on that very strong foundation that it has, but at the same time, it feels like we are at a juncture where really we need to further invest into these kind of resilient structures if we don't want these forces to continue to gain in strength that are seeking to break the European Union apart. Now, what is, I know that you don't negate these things that are going wrong, right? But so from your perspective, what are maybe the faults, maybe to just acknowledge, what could Europe be doing better? Because right now, at least in, I'm speaking from a German perspective, and here you have a lot of dismantling of many, at least state-funded programs that go into the resilience of societies. So what, from your point of view, what is holding us back to be even more resilient?
I don't think there needs to be more investment. And I don't think that we need to invest more in these structures of resilience. My point is that Europe has invested in infrastructures of resilience. They range from Interreg to Horizon Europe to the Erasmus program to the new European Bauhaus. And I have seen in my life that people who are pioneers and leaders in any of these programs are also automatically important leaders of resilience when times get really rough, when a big security crisis hits. Then it doesn't matter whether you have trained your hope competency, your hope compass, and your hope condition in architecture or in a student exchange program. But what matters is, are you ready for that special leadership of that special situation? So what I want the EU to do now is undertake a special inventory of its investments that it has been undertaking so far and do something that in German we call innovieren aus dem Bestand heraus, meaning you can often innovate from and within the structures that you have been building by changing not the what, but by changing the how do the institutions now work together with the players outside the institutions? Where do we need new nodes or new networks to just make sure that a new systemic flow of energy, of leadership, and so on can be there? So what I have been, for example, doing in the last years, I connect the Climate Pact, the European Climate Pact, which is a voluntary program that I'm part of in the European Commission, with the idea of place-based leadership. And there has been great interest inside the institutions to understand that somebody who volunteers to act as a climate and biodiversity leader in a certain region or community is probably also ready to be signed up for a civil defense cause or for a harder security situation that might arise in the next years. So what I try to say, Maite, is to look now into all these seemingly soft investments that the EU has undertaken in all these decades and change from a more patronizing relationship towards an empowered relationship with the non-state actors, meaning I would want the EU to change from a more patronizing attitude of doing programs and allowing for exchanges and dialogue for the people to actually signing up people in all these projects to solve the next problems of the EU together.
It feels like the EU could afford to trust the people sometimes a little bit more.
That's a beautiful observation. Absolutely. Because I have been active in so many private, public, or EU-led and other types of practice projects. And I realize wherever you don't just go and give a keynote or a panel to an audience, but wherever you go and you ask people to help solve a problem, they are growing with the challenge. They are blooming and exhibiting the dignity, the civic dignity that they feel when somebody from the national or the local or the European institutions asks them to help solve a problem. We see that in a lot of citizen councils where participants are selected by lottery, that in nearly all these cases where a citizen council is done right, ordinary people who have never been a political scientist or who have never worked inside a city hall are amazingly empowered and educated in many aspects and walk out from that experience with a completely renewed sense of democracy and citizenship.
Empowerment, self-worth, self, what's the word?
Efficacy.
Yes.
The key concept is self-efficacy, indeed. So whenever you make people, whether these are four-year-old children or adults, when you make them sense the self-efficacy that they have, then they usually start to bloom and blossom. I have one example. I was allowed to design, but also help implement the first 30 citizen biotopes across Tirol in the last years. And there we invited citizens, local farmers, businesses, but also mayors to spot and find spaces in their own village, in their own neighborhood that they would want to take special care of. And they developed under the really great scientific guidance of researchers and scientists, 30 biotopes together. And in the course of that project, they learned a ton about seedlings, about wildflowers, about biodiversity. But also, they told us in many of the feedback conversations how this experience not only boosted their knowledge about nature and their love for nature, but also how this really changed their democratic and community spirit. And they saw this as an empowerment and a moment of self-efficacy that many of them haven't experienced many years until the scientists running this project came to invite them.
What you describe, I think, is this shift from, again, from this pure extractive mindset of just drawing out information and, you know, this kind of transactional mindset where, you know, you present information and you present a project of what you're going to do without involving affected communities or specialists, experts, towards a more relationship building approach that is less extractive, but more around tending, almost sounds like tending the soil of this civic environment. And also redefining our relationship with nature, which is so needed when we try to, you know, tackle climate change, for instance. So again, I love your framework of hope and these three dimensions.
And here comes the key observation. Take the 100 core participants of the Tirol citizen biotopes in the last 3 years.
Yes.
These are people together with many hundreds others in their villages that have been helping. These are people who have had a profound experience of self-efficacy, but also of a renewed sense for nature and for the community. And my hypothesis is that these people are now ready for all kinds of disruptions or crises coming at their village or community. And it doesn't matter at the end of the day whether you trained hope in biodiversity or whether you trained hope in green architecture or whether you trained hope in a new intercultural exchange among youth. What matters is that you have the content and you have the networks in a certain country or a community or a topic, and you can always bring these networks to life when, for instance, a security challenge comes at us. That's why I say every investment in seemingly soft fields of resilience, from the student exchange to the Horizon Europe projects to the Erasmus Plus projects to the Interreg, whatever have you, every investment in these seemingly soft fields of resilience is an investment into the core foundation of a secure Europe.
What you're describing sounds to me like building a human infrastructure, investing, you know, what you just called seemingly soft investments. It feels to me like investing in human relationships and in spaces where humans literally go into relation with one another, with projects, with nature, with people who they may have seen before as being the other, because they are from a different sector, they work in a different sector, or they live in a different country, they speak in a different language. And for me, one of those superpowers of the European project has always been, since the beginning, the investment or the trust in the ability of people to overcome differences that may have prevented them from going into relation with one another before, and to believe that a future in which people work together, they live together, they trade, you know, they build projects together, they do politics together, that this is even possible.
I fully agree. And I want the relational infrastructure of Europe to be acknowledged and to be brought into the security conversation that we have in Brussels, both in EU headquarters, but also at NATO. Because so far, those absolutely crucial relational infrastructures and civic infrastructures that we have in different topics, maybe, but still running through all the countries, generations, regions, and so on, are arguably the key to a preventive security culture in Europe and are the key to a secure and fearless and resilient society in Europe over time. And making that connection is a big dream of mine, and bringing the civic resilience investments into the conversation on hard security preparations is what I deem an urgent and necessary and an important task and possibility of European policymakers now.
I hope so too. That brings me into wrapping up this conversation, but with one, I think, very relevant point for me, and I think this is a red thread that goes throughout this conversation. To me, the European Union itself, or the European project, and I'd like to sort of rewind in time right now to the end of the Second World War, is really one of the most hope-punk projects that I can think of. Because if you go back to the end of the Second World War, you had a continent ravaged by two world wars. You had people who saw each other not as friends, but as enemies. And then you had a few people who believed that a different kind of future would be possible. And one of those people is someone who I know has been inspiring you for many, many years, ever since you have been doing this kind of work, is Jean Monnet. Jean Monnet is one of the founding fathers of the European project and what has now become the European Union. And he was someone who, in the Second World War, who was kind of like a diplomat moving between worlds and organizing between, you know, the English and the French in order to, you know, coordinate a stronger resistance against Nazi Germany. But he's also, again, he's the one who then orchestrated a European project that included post-war Germany, Looking at the current geopolitical situation, what can we learn from Jean Monnet today?
I am really fascinated by Monet's how. How did he have impact at the time, right? Because he was most of the time not in a formal position of power. He was not in a political party. He was not mandated by governments. Usually, he did his most important processes as an entrepreneur or a freelancer. He was the son of a cognac merchant, didn't finish school, and based his life and work on his own convictions and his intention to create conditions for peace. This is what really guided him. And at the same time, he was excelling in something I would call deep convening and deep stakeholder engagement, to the point where the decisive actors on a given problem would all share the same diagnosis of the current situation. So he really convened the key players in the German and French coal and steel industry. He came up with the idea, as you said, to pool what had been the source of war into a core of peace, so coal and steel. And he brought enemies literally on the table, but far away from the microphones and, you know, from the media for many years, until the moment came when in 1950, Jean Monnet could present his plan to Robert Schuman. That was the foreign minister of France at the time. Schuman decided to run with the idea of basically a forerunner of United Europe and presented what we now know as the Schuman Plan on the 9th of May. And what is so inspiring for me with this Jean Monnet is his work in the background. He is not very well known, not very much talked about. He was extremely patient, extremely perseverant, guided by his convictions, and never turned away from the problem once there was no progress or even a backlash. And I think his focus, his clarity were really amazing. He was 100% influential, but he was also 100% mindful, the opposite of toxic masculinity. A round character, an extremely reflected individual, pure, and again, led by this intention to create conditions for peace. And the moment he had succeeded in a mission, he also often resigned from these positions. He was never interested in formal power. He knew very well what he was good at and what he was important for.
Yeah. And again, I think it's possible to take your three dimensions of hope. Jean Monnet was someone who acted with competency. He had a clear moral compass, invested a lot of time into navigating a very, very complex political landscape. And he faced a lot of resistance, but he kept going anyway. And I think it's something that is sometimes forgotten when we talk, you know, complain about how flawed the European Union is, how flawed politics is, how everything is looking dark, and everything is, you know, things keep going wrong. And why continue to invest into a Europe that is so flawed and where you have rising populism, etc., etc.? But it was never a given that we would be able to live in freedom in the first place. And that's why I think it is so interesting to look at Jean Monnet and about his approach, which is also your approach, to political change today, in this day and age, and to really realize that if we have a chance of building a hopeful, a positive future in which we do not have to descend into authoritarianism and war, but we can continue to live in peace in Western Europe. You know, there are places in Eastern Europe that are already facing war. There's always the chance for a future that involves freedom, democracy, and an upholding of European values. So I think it's very interesting for you to make that connection again to that method of Jean Monnet. Now, if you allow me, I would like to wrap up this conversation and ask you the same closing question I ask everyone. If you were about 20 years old again today in 2026, which advice would you give yourself?
I think I would dare to face an institutional career. Applying for the European institutions at the time when Austria joined the EU seemed to me like a monster that I would never be able to master. And I understand now, many years later, just how worthwhile it would have been facing that monster, because it's exactly the creative and the innovative personalities who can unfold impact inside institutions if they manage, to find their own workflow and comfort and place in these institutions, if they stay for a long time, if they find mentors along the way, if they aren't bullied away too early because of their ideas, then these entrepreneurs can really learn how to use their unconventional strengths in a very smart and positive manner. And in hindsight, or today, I would tell my 20-year-old self to face the application tests for the EU institutions, even if it means to wear a suit for work or to learn how to operate in very strong hierarchical systems.
Thank you very, very much, Verena, for your time and for all your wisdom.
Thank you, Maite. This was incredibly inspiring.
Thank you. That was Verena Ringler, founder of European Commons and Agora, a boutique think and do tank based in Innsbruck, Austria. Verena started as a journalist, traveled extensively through post-communist Europe, and witnessed deep societal transformations. Wherever she went, she says, she saw people rise to leadership, seemingly out of nowhere. Hope for her is three things: a competence, a compass, and a condition of resistance. Verena's framework of hope was new to me, and I appreciated just how applicable it is to so many different contexts and people. Take the current events in Albania, for example. What may look like a spontaneous movement, Verena observed, is actually the result of decades of patient, professional work ahead of this moment by different societal actors. She compared this current moment in Albania to 1989, when Monday prayer meetings in Eastern Germany had been going on for years before the wall came down, laying the groundwork. A moment of peaceful rupture, she says, becomes possible when the right time comes because the soil has been tended for so long. For me, that metaphor of tending soil runs through much of what Verena does. In her work today, she seeks to strengthen the resilience of Europe. Investments in what she calls seemingly soft resilience through EU programs such as Erasmus, Horizon Europe, Interrail, or European Bauhaus form a deep foundation of a secure and democratic Europe. And these kinds of investments, she says, should be understood as part of a harder preventive security strategy. Verena is a passionate advocate for the European project. Conflict, she says, or rather, the management of conflict is part of the design. Upholding constructive dialogue and integrating further along different policy fields, as seems necessary in light of current geopolitical developments, is a decision and not a given. We spoke briefly about Jean Monnet, one of the founding fathers of the EU and a role model of Verena's. He understood this from the beginning. In Verena's framework of hope, Monet had the competence, the compass, and the resistance necessary to envision a peace project after decades of war. For me, the EU has always been a hope punk project, and I'd say that Monet was very much in sync with this spirit. There is still a lot to learn from him today, and Verena is holding a masterclass on his approach in Innsbruck on June 27th of 2026, so for anyone interested, I'll provide details in the show notes. Thank you for listening to today's episode of Hope Punk. I look forward to welcoming you again next time. Goodbye.